got up. He gave the most beautiful talk you've ever heard. And each one of the things that I had outlined, he gave an answer or a rebuttal or agreed with it. And we got to be great friends as a result, needless to say. And to my knowledge, I was one of the few designers in this town that ever took an engineering course, because I felt sincerely that I was lacking from drawing pretty pictures and beautiful design sketches. But if anybody had asked me how to make a side view or a plan view or a front or rear view, I couldn't have told them, you know. So I had that extra knowledge embedded, even though many times I didn't need it. I could always give a sensible answer if I did need it. And it worked out very well. Ed got killed up here in Saginaw about 3-4 years ago.
An airplane crash. Yeah. Yes.
And the fog. And I miss him. He was a great speaker. I used to go to New York to the SAE and the Automobile Association Engineering just to hear him talk. He was beautiful.
Yeah.
And he had a personality was just absolutely great. He's always had a little bit of a smile on his face. And these damn engineers and designers would come far and wide just to hear him talk. And he'd always include, he'd look around the damn room, you know. And I remember once in New York, I went to hear him, and he had some of the designers and engineers in the audience. And he'd say, "Remember, Bill, on that foggy night out in the middle of North Dakota when we hit that snowstorm and we fell and we went, wound up in a ditch?" And he says, you wound up with a wrecker and got us out. Or, "Remember in Arizona how the air conditioning quit, Jimmy, and we finally fixed that damn thing so we could get home again?" He had this wonderful habit of including everybody in his talk, so that when he talked, everybody felt they were a part of this thing. That's an art that very few people use and have. And besides being a wonderful speaker, he also remembered everybody's name in the audience so he could include them in his speech, you see. And that's a beautiful guy. I mean, learn a lot from people like that.
The Corvair was unfairly his albatross later in his career.
I had one, and it was a wonderful car. It was underpowered, and if you took it around a turn too fast or not just right, it would, the thing would switch the back with the front. And it was you had to be a pretty good driver to manipulate one of these damn things. Yeah. It wasn't as bad as the Dingbat from Washington, D.C.
Ralph Nader.
Unsafe at any speed. That wasn't true. It was underpowered, yes. And it was, it wasn't any more dangerous, really, than the Volkswagen, which were both rear-engine cars.
Yeah.
But nobody ever said anything about the Volkswagen, and everybody beat the Corvair to death because apparently in America nobody believes we can do anything well. And that's not true. Johnny had one of the Corvairs, which was the high-powered one, and I had the little white one, and Johnny took some kids out one night and rolled mine down a mountain about 5 times, and he called me from Ohio Valley Hospital, and he said, "Dad, we had a little trouble."
"A little trouble."
I said, "Well, what happened?" He said, "Well, the Corvair got away from me." And I said, "Are you hurt?" "No." I said, "We're okay." Well, I went over to Ohio Valley to see how they were, and one of them had a split head, and he was all patched up. One of them had a broken arm, and Johnny had a broken wrist, and they were patched up with Band-Aids here and there, you know. I said, "Well, you guys ready to go home?" "Sure." Took them home. Big deal, exciting, you know.
Yeah.
I went to see my Corvair the next day, and I almost had a heart attack.
Oh.
The thing was rolled up like a piece of bread, you know, like a bread loaf, and there wasn't one window in it, and the whole damn front end was pushed into the windshield, the whole back end was pushed into the rear light, and I finally reached in between all the broken glass and got the registration out of the glove compartment, which was all anything was worth, you know, except the tires. And I sold it for junk. And I was absolutely amazed how these kids got out alive. I guess if they hadn't been young and bounced around, you know, the way they do, like a rubber ball, they'd be dead.
Sure.
And
remarkable.
I unfortunately had 2 lawsuits on my hands after that happened.
Wow.
Both of our best friends down in the valley sued me, and the insurance company took care of it, thank God. But and we're still friends with the people normally.
That's good.
They get excited, you know, like the dog biting the kids. And
did you ever call up Ed and say, "Hey,
I've been through hell with the dogs and the kids and everything else."
Welcome to the club. Did you ever call up Ed and say, "Hey, we survived in one of your Corvairs"? He would have been interested.
I never even thought of it. It was a hell of a hell of a good idea.
Yeah.
Should have called Ralph Nader.
Yeah, let me move you back to Raymond Loewy. I know you've said some interesting things about him. Tell me your last impression of him in terms of his impact on industrial design. Was he an authentic genius?
He was literally the father of industrial design.
Mm-hmm.
Not automotive design, but industrial design.
Mm-hmm.
He was of the same magnitude in industrial design, in making it popular. Now Dreyfus was there, and some of the other people.
Bill Geddes,
and some of the other people were I assume they were as good. I didn't meet these people, unfortunately. But Loewy was the promoter and the schemer and the PR man, literally, for industrial design, the way Harley Earl was for automotive design.
Mm-hmm.
And God, I learned so much from this person. He was so sophisticated and so beautiful in the way he presented himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he always talked to us in a normal voice. When he got up to make a speech, he always had his French accent that he put on. Everybody was impressed, you know, like mad. Ray always had his accent ready.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went to London with him, he insisted that his men stay at the finest hotels, or they have the most expensive apartments, or they belong to the most exclusive clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And we belonged to the Chesterfield Club, and we belonged to the Churchill Club, and we belonged to anything that was anything, so that we could entertain our customers if he wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were too important, we'd call him at Claridge's, and he would entertain them. And he'd check in with us almost every night at the Chesterfield Club.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go over the different areas during the day, and he'd tell us what he thought we did right and what we did wrong, just as McGuire did many years before, except that it was a different attitude.
Mm-hmm.
You know? There's a right way of doing things and a wrong way.
How did you get into automotive design?
We were delighted with Loewy because he was nothing short of a gentleman. He was great.
He must have been. How did you get into automotive design? He'd come from product design.
Well, he was always crazy about cars.
Was he?
And he never agreed with the way Detroit built and designed their automobiles, because they were big, heavy, cumbersome monsters, as he described them.
Right.
And when we worked for him down at Studebaker, he wanted a small, light car, extremely lightweight, hopefully, and a car that didn't have any extra baggage or extra weight or extra steel or extra, you know. And he had signs all over the design studios, "Weight is the enemy." This was his slogan,
credo.
"Weight is the enemy." Mm-hmm. And we never forgot that.
Mm-hmm.
And when the little Starlight Coupe came out, people went crazy over it, because we had built this tiny little Studebaker, and we had windows all the way around the back.
Yes.
Unfortunately, air conditioning hadn't been popularized or invented yet to that extent. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, that car would probably still be going today, because during the day, that great greenhouse that we had around the rear became extremely hot. You know,
what year was this?
Well, that's 1942 or three.
Mm-hmm.
Probably 44. I don't know, just before I went to England.
Uh-huh.
And we popularized all these cars, and Vince Gardner made a magnificent convertible, and they built that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a four-door sedan, and we had the little Champion, and then we had the big Studebaker, whose name I've forgotten. I don't know what the hell they call that big car, but it wasn't nearly as graceful as the little car.
Mm-hmm.
We designed the little car first as sort of an example, and it became a classic. And the big car looked, again, as Lowy said, cumbersome by comparison. You know,
it wasn't the commander, was it?
It could have been.
Yeah.
It wasn't the Studebaker president anymore, which was the hot dog.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Probably could have been a commander.
Mm-hmm.
They had some strange names.
Yes.
Nash had some strange names.
Didn't
and they still have. They're naming their little American car some of the damnedest things I ever heard of. Even Chevrolet's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But
Lowy's genius.
Lowy was a pioneer,
mm-hmm.
and he was when we were in England doing the Humbers, we had across the street this gentleman named Colonel Wren,
mm-hmm.
and that I told you about, mm-hmm. Johnny Cuccio.
Yes.
had trouble with, and we designed a. In England they had these old time washers that you worked by.
Oh, yes.
Crank, you know, by hand.
I remember it well.
We, after we got through with the Humbers, we worked on the Ringers and modernized those, and people bought them by the thousands. They thought, Jesus, fantastic. And they were still the old-time Ringer, but all we did was aerodynamically modernized them and cleaned them up.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we went to the refrigerators and did those.
Still working with Lowy.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah, and we did all this stuff, and he did one of the first Frigidaires, you know. Remember that old refrigerator that had the great big air cooling on
top? Oh, yes,
yes, he did that, and people went nuts.
Oh, yeah.
And that was one of his first jobs, and he finally got the damn dynamics to enclose this area,
mm-hmm.
and shot the air out the back so mm-hmm. it would still cool. And that became literally the first modern refrigerator, and you
mm-hmm.
did an awful lot of those for Sears, Roebuck later,
mm-hmm.
and various people around the United States. He did one adding machine that was just a horrible-looking thing when he got a hold of it, and it was one of his first jobs, and he spent day and night to make a clay model over this damn thing and called a guy back. I think the fellow was either in England or France or somewhere. And he flew across, and I guess he almost had a heart attack when he saw this new machine that Lowy had designed because it was so beautiful.
Mm.
And they ran this damn thing for 20 years, you know, after he had designed it with no changes. Now, that shows the measure of the guy and how far ahead he thought, you
mm-hmm.
see.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen some of the damnedest stuff. He did this whole damn NASA stuff into the atmosphere and the stratosphere.
The very early part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
About 1961, 1962, mm-hmm. I used to have lunch with him. He was like a little boy. He was so enthusiastic about
mm-hmm.
all the stuff he'd been given to do to mm-hmm. go out into space. And he'd tell me about it by the hour.
Mm-hmm.
He'd think, my God,
mm-hmm.
this is incredible. Mm-hmm. Betty Reese used to get a big kick out of him. She was his PR talent and his private secretary,
mm-hmm.
and did all his all his private work and all his promotional work to the news, and
mm-hmm.
she used to kid him all the time, and she'd say, well, Mr. Lowy's on his sixth facelift now. And he didn't like that at all. Oh God, that used to bother him to death, because he was one of the first exponents of health and lifting barbells and running and keeping in shape, and he's always in fantastic shape. And
influenced by Bernard McFadden.
He's 93 or 94 years old today.
Incredible.
And as far as I know, he's still alive.
Yes.
I haven't contacted him now for 4 or 5 years since I retired. But when I first got into New York to go over to London with him, he couldn't find me a room at any hotel in New York. And he finally grabbed me one day, and he says, come with me. So I came with him, and I carried one of his bags, and I didn't know what the hell he wanted, but he was going to the Pennsylvania train station to get on the train to do one of his jobs. And he says, I've made arrangements with my housekeeper, Ella, for you to stay at the Waldorf Astoria in 35F. He said, that's my personal suite.
Oh.
He says, I want you to take care of it and be very discreet. Well, I was floored, you know, me staying at the Waldorf Astoria. And I went up on the elevator and rang the doorbell, and Ella came to the door, little fatso. And she says, "Oh, Mr. Loy told me you were expected." So she gave me the keys to the liquor cabinet.
Oh, my.
She says, "Mr. Loy keeps us locked up because all of the people and the servants come in and steal all his whiskeys." And so I had the keys to the liquor cabinet, and she left quietly and gave me the keys to the apartment.
Uh-huh.
I wandered all over in amazement. This was the most elegantly appointed place I'd ever been in my life, you know, and the bed sheets were all silk, and there was a faint perfume going through the air that drove me crazy.
Mm.
And I tried to get hold of one of the windows, and they had never been opened before. I was trying to get some fresh, dusty air from New York, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I, out of curiosity, I wandered through his cupboard, you know, and slid them open, sliding doors. And he had always worn what I thought was his single suit, a gray flannel suit, you know, I guess, which was the epitome of style in New York and Madison Avenue. And I thought the poor guy only had one suit of clothes. And I went through these damn covers, and this is just one place he lived, you know, outside of his other four homes around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll bet you he had 50 gray suits.
Mm.
And they were graded from light to dark to medium. Then they went from light blue to dark blue. Then he went from dark blue to black to midnight on his tuxedos.
Mm.
And on the other side, there were overcoats and top coats and sport coats. And he probably had 400 pairs of shoes along the floors. Holy God. I was just speechless, you know.
All the same cup.
Opened up his liquor cabinet, and here was this great big expanse of bottles, you know. And it wasn't any fun to drink by yourself, so I closed it and locked it up and went downstairs.
Right.
And I never forget, I was in the Golden Pheasant room or something down in the Waldorf, and I'm sitting there eating, and the eating time was over, and I was having some food. And I looked down, and here several little mice running around on the floor, you know, picking up the leftovers, and I was shocked, you know.
Yeah.
And so when Loy came back, he said, "Well, did you enjoy it?" I said, "Oh, Mr. Loy," said, "that was a great privilege. Thank you very much." I said, "But I went down to the Golden Pheasant room, and I found little mice running around, and I was afraid they were going to crawl up my leg." He says, "Oh, no," he says, "they won't hurt you. But just remember one thing, they're the most expensively fed mice in the whole world." Didn't bother him in the least. I loved that.
The post-war Studebaker was largely his, wasn't it? Or am I mistaken?
Oh, yeah, he had the Studebaker almost until, I know he ran until 1953.
Mm-hmm.
Vince Gardner was down there, and he designed that one Studebaker that had sort of an airplane nose, you know, with a point, without a propeller, and he designed an awful lot of good stuff. Vince was a great designer, in addition to making leather instrument panels.
Mm-hmm.
He always had this amazing desire to kill himself. I don't know what brought that on. The first time was when he was with Marcel over in Grosse Pointe. He had this girl he loved dearly. And she got tired because he didn't want to get married, so she started dating another guy. The first thing I know, I had given him my business card, and cops called me, and they said, "Do you know Vince Gardner?" I said, "Yes, very well. I live with him on Newport." He said, "Well, he's in General Hospital."
Oh.
Here he was in a restraint, you know.
Oh, no.
And I became responsible for him. I said, "Well, let him out." I said, "He lives with me." I said, "He's spawning over a love affair." So they released him, and he came back, started over again.
Mm-hmm.
Several years later, he tried it again, didn't succeed,
mm-hmm.
and I got him two jobs in Pittsburgh, and he did very angry.
Mm-hmm.
He did fine all by himself. He was a loner, and the second job I got him over in McKeesport, he was in charge of the whole plastics and a plaster shop like this fellow at Continental, and he quit in 2 weeks.
Hmm.
I says, "What's the matter, Vince?" He says, "Well, those fellas put two young fellas under me to learn all I know."
Oh.
He says, "I don't want them to know anything."
You know,
he's very jealous of his knowledge, you know, and very strange, and he was sort of a psycho. And so then he came back, and I tried to get in touch with him several times.
Uh-huh.
And I invited him to lunch, but he never came over, and he went down to Auburn, Indiana, and got in this old place where he had all his pleasant years with Gordon Burig.
Mm-hmm.
And started this machine shop and design shop and did some work for some people over in Canada, I understand, mm-hmm. Toronto perhaps, London, Ontario. And they apparently didn't pay him, and mm-hmm. he got angry, and he needed money, and I mm-hmm. loaned him some money here and there, I don't think he ever did get his money, but when we last heard of him, he'd put the exhaust pipe back in the car, and away he went. You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, none of us were around to stop him, so yeah. It was the end. It must be a wonderful way to go, because many of my friends did that. Peter Muller Monk and his wife and everybody in Pittsburgh I knew, and we had voices.
I hope I can answer it.
You can. It's not a question that you... I want you to reserve your last and most eloquent description of the mentors you've had in your life for William Clay Ford. Tell me about the first time you met him, how briefly anecdotes about how you came to be connected with the project, his concept, and your feeling for him as a person and as a catalyst in getting the Mark True to fruition. I'll let you think about that.
Well, Bill was so... To begin with, Mrs. Edsel Ford
mm-hmm.
must have been... one of the greatest and stern mothers on earth, because she raised these three kids, including Josephine, who married Walter Buell Ford. We always accused Josephine of marrying Walter Buell Ford so she didn't have to change the initials on her luggage. No relation, you know.
Right.
And it was wonderful. And Josephine always got a kick out of that. Because
mm-hmm.
she took it in the way it was intended, you know. Mm-hmm. But here they were, all these kids having millions and millions of dollars. And we always accused her of being cheap because she didn't want to change her luggage initials. But this mother, she was initially responsible, I understand, for hiring Ernie Breech.
Oh, this is Eleanor.
Who was president of Bendix.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what her name was, except Mrs. Edsel Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And I never met her.
Mm-hmm.
She must have been a wonderful person. And she taught these guys how to work damn hard in spite of their millions, mm-hmm. which is something I always admired. Mm-hmm. I knew Spike Briggs out here, and Spike was a fantastic guy.
Mm-hmm. Walter's son.
Yeah, but he had a horrible time committing himself to go to work every day.
Mm-hmm.
He and I used to go out on some wild tears, along with guys like Howard O'Leary,
oh, yes.
who was under Harley Earl, a fantastic Irishman that I loved dearly, and
styling administrator,
owned a big Cadillac agency over in Grosse Pointe.
Mm-hmm.
He and I used to bum around together when I got to U.S. Steel. I'd come to town. I'd call up Howard because he was absolutely a lonely soul. After he got out of GM, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these people just go nuts like I did.
Mm-hmm.
And, Howard and I would get together and we'd just pow, off the wild blue yonder and up go the cups. And Spike was the same type of guy. He just mm-hmm. couldn't concentrate because he had all this damn money, and he eventually died of a liver ailment or a heart attack, but a charming person.
Mm-hmm.
And Howard died the same way, mm-hmm. unfortunately. He used to come over with a chauffeur to the Topanga's down on Grand Boulevard. And mm-hmm. I had an office on the 9th floor in the GM building. We'd get together. And they always say, people of the same type get together. Well, we did. You know, I guess we were. There's a certain age in life when you become sophisticated or ignorant enough to drink too much.
Mm-hmm.
We did. And we had a grand time. And I considered it a privilege to know these guys, even though I knew their problems and they knew mine.
Mm-hmm.
And like my grandmother always said, she says, if you think the other people have problems, look in your own droke. Which meant look in your own plate first and see your problems, and then don't criticize anybody else. You know, try and clean up your own act, which showed an awful lot of intellectual experience, you know, the old folks had.
Yes.
And
and you think Bill was cut from this mold? He was able to...
Bill was so beautiful as a person, and so naive and willing to learn, that I like to think that I taught him an awful lot, and he was very eager to learn. He was hungry for information about design, engineering, techniques. When we got into the sketches and all the rest of it, he sold all the board of directors on all of the illustrations and showed them and exposed them. And when we got into the quarter size, he was terrifically interested in all of the models and how we build them and our clay tools. He was just hungry for information. And you take a person like that and you're eager to show them what the hell's going on. You know? And Bill gathered up information like a damn sponge, you know. And when we get up to the full-size clay models, well, he'd come out, he was very shy, and he'd come out at 6 or 7 o'clock after we had left, and he'd look at all the stuff we had done. Every once in a while, we'd find a knife wound or a long stripe along the side of the clay model, and a little note pinned to it, you know, with maybe one of our clay tools pinning it to the model, and say, I'm sorry I ruined your model. I was experimenting. You know? And that shows the measure of the guy. You know, he's just beautiful. And we'd have these meetings, and he was always nothing but charming.
Very amenable to new
ideas.
We
had the greatest times together. He had a table in his office like this one that I always admired, so I called him one day and admired his table, and he said, well, I'll have Dick Morris make it possible for you to buy one of those at discount. And this is a table.
This is the
same damn table he had. Mine split down the middle over there from a trip back to Pittsburgh.
Oh.
If you look at it, you can see the split. It runs all over this. This thing's in two pieces. It's a piece of Carrazza from Italy, and I can't even find another one, much less buy one.
Well, Bill Ford had great taste, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Oh, he was beautiful. The Ford boys apparently all had people who would select their clothes and help them to achieve this quiet good taste that people of that caliber should have. And
ours inherited from their father, I suspect.
Or possibly, yes. But Bill always dressed very beautifully and conservatively, and always wore a plain tie with a striped suit or a plaid suit, and always wore the right collar and the right shirts and the right shoes. And I've only seen him with one pair of shoes on in my life that I thought were overdone, and I think he went off the deep end on those. That's not much criticism to give a man that has good taste. And when I was home, he was asked to give a talk on the Mark II down at French Lick, Indiana, to the Continental Club. And he called me and he said, would you go along with me and George Haviland to French Lick? He says, I have to give a talk down there, and he says, I might get stuck on some of the
technical points,
the details, etc. And I was delighted and complimented, you know. And so we went down, and he gave a talk right off the cuff. Beautiful.
Spontaneous.
We had dinner with one of the doctors from Kalamazoo who owned about 6 Mark IVs. And
Gilmore.
Dr. Schaefer.
Oh, Schaefer. Okay.
And... Bill got in there, and we had to pick up all of, we had a, the thing, room hadn't been made up, the room where he was going to speak, so we all got these folding chairs and put them out, and he was helping us put all the chairs out, and everybody was working, and finally all the people drifted in, and he wasn't at all put out by this. I would have been miffed, you know, because you make this presentation, offer months before, and you expect things to be set up.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Just like when I was out in California doing a talk for Ford, they put my presentation on one of these platters, you know, and I took this damn machine I had to project this projector, and the damn table was tipping every damn thing I did. I had a horrible time. We kept putting matches underneath the things and plates and everything else to make it stop, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it got to be a laughing matter because my goddamn things were going off the screen and all over the place. And finally, we got to settle down. But this shows how you don't properly prepare for a talk. And it usually gets people down. It didn't bother Bill in the least, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He got up there and he made the talk just as he understood it, and he presented it with flair and dignity and fun. He poked fun at a lot of people, including me, and we had a good time. And it got to be so noisy in there that he asked me several questions, and I couldn't even hear him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd try and answer him, and he'd finally go, forget it, you know. It wasn't important anyway. And one old woman got up there, and she owned a 1908 Ford, a 1928 Ford, and a couple of Model Ts, and he ran over and kissed her on both cheeks. And,
well, Bill Ford's vision of a reincarnation of his father's masterpiece, the so-called Mark One, and your bringing it to fruition is quite an achievement in design history, I would say.
Well, they seemed pleased. I wasn't. I was never. I never thought the Mark Two we did. Was as good as the mark that Edsel did.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted it to be better. Maybe I'm a perfectionist, but I always felt that we had fallen a little bit short. Now, apparently, I'm wrong again, just as I was with Bourdonnais, because everybody loves the damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And I wanted it to be better than that.
What would you have done?
And there were several designs we had in the studio that we did that I thought were better. There were a couple of designs that some of the competitors did when we invited them in that I thought could have been more useful had we been able to refine them into the image that I had. But unfortunately, we had people above us and the board of directors who literally have a lot to say about your design.
Mm.
And you, contrary to what they think about a designer and contrary to what they say, this is my design or this is your design or someone else's design, is not necessarily true because it goes through so many phases of refinement or practicability, like this one picture that I showed you. Our first Continental had louvers all along the side that I wanted desperately, and I wanted these chrome wire wheels from Dayton to be on that car. You know, we could have made them heavier and made them work, but the engineers, no names, wouldn't take the time to refine these and have special wire wheels made so that we could go ahead with what I thought was my design. And I was very disappointed because the details are the very thing that makes the car. The small little louvers, the beautiful green blue of the instrumentation behind the dials, and everything had to be perfect on this car. We had brushed instrument panels and the dials, and everything had to be just right, and all of the different little detents down here that you worked in. And when that wasn't done, it left me with a hollow feeling like we hadn't succeeded in our job, you see. And it's absolutely frustrating to work day and night on something, and then you get it all finished, and they take pictures of it, and then they don't put it out the way you have specified, you see. And this is a great problem with about, I dare say, 80% of the automobiles that get on the road are all made by a prodding planning committee or an executive committee or someone who's very high up in the company who has the wherewithal to tell you how to design when they're not really a designer themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the designer winds up with a very great frustration,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell can you do, you know?
Well, Bill did pretty much come through with...
Yes, with what he had to come through with what he thought was the design that Harley and Gordon Burig and myself,
mm-hmm.
It was a compromise like everything is.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yes.
And so...
But it has endured.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Well, again, I feel like Bourdonnais. The thing was successful... Except the board of directors wouldn't believe that a $10,000 car could be sold. You know, it was successful to the extent that we sold every damn one we built,
mm-hmm.
and the thing is still selling well, second and third hand today. So
mm-hmm.
apparently, to the public and to the modern formal people for which it was designed, it was a success, but not necessarily to me.
No, there were no men of vision. At that time.
Damn it. I guess, as my wife said, she's always been my greatest fan. She says, nothing is perfect. She
right.
says, you do the best you can, and then forget it. Well, she can do that, but I'll be damned if I can. You know? I'd like to get right back in here today and go for the whole damn thing and modernize it and fix it up the way I wanted it. You know?
Marvelous.
I could make a hell of a car out of it. But I finally bought the Mark III and put those together, and it's got some nice lines on it. It still has a long hood, and it's got the little, literally the same back end that I designed for the configuration
mm-hmm.
on the spare tire, and it's similar.
It's a classic, yeah.
In a certain way, and I like the Mark IIIs very much.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave Ash, I understand, was responsible for that particular car while I was at the U.S. Steel,
mm-hmm.
and... It took me a while to get used to it.